You may know you're listening to this show along the Marketing Podcast Network, but did you know there are other great shows on MPN to help your business? Christy Hyler hosts a fantastic podcast called Own It. Christy, tell us more about the show.
Own It is all about celebrating women and non-binary advertising agency owners. We talk about buying out of the Boys Club of Advertising because less than 1% of ad agencies are owned by women.
And where can people subscribe?
You can find the podcast at untilyouownit.com. We're also on the Marketing Podcast Network at marketingpodcast.net. And of course, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
You heard her. Go subscribe.
On Brand is brought to you by my new book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Available now at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, or your favorite bookseller. Publishers Weekly calls Get Scrappy a helpful digital marketing Bible. You can read the first chapter, get special digital extras, and learn more now at GetScrappyBook.com.
Welcome to On Brand, a podcast for brand builders by brand builders. Here's your host, Nick Westergaard of Brand Driven Digital.
Hey, brand builders, have we got a show for you? This week's guest is Bill Price. Bill is a partner with big data player Antuit, leading its global customer experience and customer service advanced analytics program, and is president of Driva Solutions that has worked with over 150 clients to forge the balance between cost controls and greater customer loyalty. Bill co-founded the 9-country Limebridge Global Alliance, chairs the 41-company Global Operations Council, has taught at the University of Washington and Stanford MBA programs, and is the lead author of The Best Service is No Service, Liberating Your Customers from Customer Service, Keep Them Happy, and Control Cost, and Your Customer Rules, Delivering the Me-to-Be Experiences that Today's Customers Demand. Bill served as Amazon.com's first worldwide VP of customer service, and before that, held senior positions at MCI, ACP, and McKinsey. He was named Call Center Pioneer in 1997 in its inaugural year. Bill graduated from Dartmouth and Stanford and lives in Bellevue, Washington. Bill, welcome to On Brand.
Nick, thanks very much for allowing me to join you today. I'm excited about this conversation.
Well, this is a fun backstory because I was reminded of all of the great pioneering work that I just read about to our guests there in a recent conversation with our mutual acquaintance, Rob Rauenhorst. Mm-hmm. And I had seen you speak as I sit on the board of the Marketing Institute here at the University of Iowa years ago. And he said, you know, who you should talk to is Bill. And he talked with me a bit about what you'd been up to recently. So beyond what I mentioned in the bio, what are you up to recently?
Well, I'll give you one example in particular, Nick. In fact, I was just in the middle of an email message this morning, and so it's top of mind. One of the situations that's always bugged me about marketing and customer service over the last 20 years is that we tend to over-survey customers to try to get their opinion, their reaction, their situation in life about a particular interaction with us. And this is apart from having panels or ongoing surveying mechanisms. So the survey response rates that I've seen with my clients and companies that I work with is declining. The skewed range of responses, either very high or very low, is also a little bit discouraging. So a lot of the companies that I know out there tend to interpolate, or they tend to fill in the blanks and try to come up with different models to explain why the response rate is so low and figure out what some of the non-respondents are doing. So what I've been up to, among other things recently, is trying to come up with a way to either replace the standard survey mechanism or supplement it with some more intuitive thinking. In other words, if you figure out what a customer should be experiencing across his or her connections or journey, let's call it, everything from searching and browsing to buying and using something, maybe returning something, getting more of something, well, whatever it is across a multi-step process you might call the customer journey, you ought to be able to figure out, well, what should their expectations be? How long should they be waiting on hold? How long should it take for them to get something shipped to them? Questions about accuracy and about reliability. And then have a data feed that starts to calculate something like a customer satisfaction score or a net promoter score or the customer effort score, well, whatever that kind of mechanism is. And then track that along that journey, such that if Nick is not experiencing what we think he should experience because of all these data feeds and this analysis, then maybe we should do something with him or for him as he proceeds along the path, because otherwise he may just bounce out. He may never give us a response to a survey. We just may never see him again. And then let's figure out how to get, maybe suggest a coupon or suggest some sort of a personal call or some other way to restore the journey, restore the relationship, and then test to see how that goes. So in the big data parlance, that means having a recommendations engine and then doing machine learning to find out whether the recommendation really worked or not, and then find out whether Nick actually stays with us and maybe buys more from us in the future relative to a control group because we've had this engine in the background working. So that's the sort of thing that I'm working on with a number of companies to, again, either replace surveys that are tending to be less reliable or augment them, but have this sort of ongoing analysis.
Well, it's so interesting because it does seem like there's this chasm today of exactly what you said about we're over-surveyed. We're kind of beat over the head with the idea that that we can learn so much about our customers. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we go where we've always gone, which is the survey. But then on the other side of the chasm is this age of big data and mm-hmm. all of this information that we have. But I think, yeah, in absence of some other model, we aren't connecting the dots to use all of that intuitively mm-hmm. together.
I think it's the connecting dots that's gotten me excited about the new wave of analytics, whether it's big data or even the company I work with sometimes calls it little data. You don't have to have a highfalutin big repository. You just have to basically mash up or pull together different data sources that typically don't work with each other. To give you another very quick example, we're doing work with a company starting soon that will profile some of their best performers in their customer service centers on behalf of customers. So we're looking at customer-based metrics, but from an employee point of view. And right now, those data exist in HR databases, in desktop software, in some CSAT information, quality assurance data. I think we've tabulated at least 12 different data sources in 5 or 6 different types of languages. And so typically, those never come together to give you a composite view. And I think that's one of the real signal advantages of using some of these new data analytics.
Well, I like that you snuck little data in there because I think we can kind of get lost in big data unless it's actually something we can do something with, that we can make a decision based on. And I think sometimes, it's those we have the dots, but connecting them is not as elementary as it sounds.
Well, totally right. So let me give you an example, which probably falls in between the two, but actually our current discussion is one on the easier, the little data side of it. This is a company that's a pretty well-known brand that all your listeners would probably know about. So I can't really disclose who they are, and I don't want to go into too much detail so someone's going to sit there going, well, I think I know who that is. But anyway, they have a classic website with home delivery and delivery through the internet. They have retail stores and they sell through, they have their own retail stores and they sell through other retailers. So it's kind of a multi-channel play. And what they want to try to figure out is when someone calls up one of our contact centers, one of our call centers, and inquires about product availability or this or that about our service policy, whatever it might be, and they don't buy something when they had the chance online. I'm sorry, when they had the chance with a customer service rep, but subsequently did buy something, either in a retail store or online, how can we associate the value and actually credit some value to that conversation that occurred in the call center, in the customer service center? So in other words, most customer service centers in a siloed mentality say, we had I'll make up a number, 10% conversion sales rate this week. 10% of the customers that came in wanting to buy something bought something. So, hey, that's better than it was last week, so we're on a positive trend. But it could be that that far understates the value of that service center, because it could be that three times that number of customers who had an interaction with a customer service sales rep or a sales rep in a center, subsequently, within some predictable range of time, went online, went back online, went to a retail store, either the company store or a third-party store, and bought the product that they talked about. So that they basically use the call center as a affirmation, or maybe to get information or some sort of a validation, and then they went off and bought something. And this company is saying, how can we pull together these different data sources and then basically create a little bit of a credit bank or credit score, and maybe even bring it down to the individual level? So we know that certain individuals are doing a better job in that post-call purchase history, and others maybe aren't doing as well. So how can we improve their training? So it gets to a lot of related questions, but it's sort of on the range of this big data, little data, and our first quest will be to figure out, well, are these different data sources available, and then how do we pull them together?
Well, and I think all of this too kind of ladders up to kind of recasting how we build brands today, because I mean, everything you're talking about, the customer journey, and you know, for the longest time, it's been enough to get people to realize that it's not just kind of hitting people with the same ads that we've always been hitting people with. It's about experience, and it's one of those things that people nod along with, yes, experience. But there's some number that I saw out there that everybody recognizes the value of experience, but nobody exactly knows how to deliver that. And what you're talking about seems like the building blocks of how to do that, from the online experience, then I would also assume to the human service that is supplementing that as well.
It is both of those. And in fact, customers don't really care sometimes. They just have a problem or a question, or maybe they have a suggestion to make, and they just want to have the opportunity to express that and or get that resolved. You mentioned the two books that David Jaffe and I wrote together. In the latest one, we researched companies, went out around the world in person and in phone interviews, and we researched companies that had very good reputations for delivering great customer experience. Some of the classic U.S. brands like Nordstrom, for example, T-Mobile and others, but also some companies that are based offshore, a company called Yamato Transport in Japan, Shoes of Prey in Australia, Vente Privé, which is a flash sales leader in France. And we interviewed these companies, and they all told us a number of different similar themes that we put into the book. And one of them was using the customer's wording for this, an expression called, you make it easy for me, or you know me, you remember me. This is how we posed it in the book, Nick. And so these companies were all saying, we don't exactly know how to measure the value of those statements, but we know we like them. We know we want our customers to say them. In fact, we also know we don't want them to say the opposite. So we actually have in the book something we call the failure statements, which obviously would be something like, you don't know me, you don't remember me, why did I have to repeat myself? You know, why was it so hard for me to sign up for something? And a few of the companies do the math, but they just have a strong feeling from looking and talking to their customers, listening to their customers, that the customers say, because you make it easy for me, I'm going to stay with you. So they've got this strong connection of loyalty and brand connection. And that's what I think we're talking about here is making sure you got customers in that who can express the experience in a way you can begin to associate it with their ongoing loyalty.
I love that. I love the you make it easy for me. And again, that they're not, I think sometimes we get lost just as much as we can get lost in the quantitative. We can also be similarly dumbfounded by the qualitative. But I think that that's big that they recognized that means something, that those statements of, right. of making it easy, even though they didn't know exactly like what sort of machine to plug those into. Understanding the value and the value of that and the converse too of the failure statements I think is huge. And I like that, you know, as you talk about those kind of those rough-hewn intuitions, but they're coming from those service leaders like Nordstrom that theoretically all of us want to provide service at that level, and even they don't always have a secret formula for cracking that.
They don't have the formula, but what they do have, Nick, is they've got stories. They tell stories all over the place. Each of these companies we interviewed were full of stories. They rely on that as what you might call tribal knowledge, but they see it as a higher level than that, which is we can't necessarily train specific skills, but we can share stories. And we can share stories from transcripts, from interviews, from email threads, from what something happened maybe 4 years ago to me, and I'm now the trainer, so I'm going to tell you what happened. And interestingly, where I worked a while ago, as you point out, at Amazon was full of storytelling as well. When Jeff Bezos would have quarterly analyst meetings or all-hands meetings, he would often have someone from his staff call customer service, my team, and ask for stories that he could use to reinforce a point he wanted to make. And there were always stories to reinforce any point you want to make, but we would then have those and be able to supply them. And he'd have a whole bunch of them. At one point, Amazon put those stories on the website. I don't think they're there anymore. But the idea was to share to current and prospective customers, this is how we want to behave. This is how we want you to be able to work with us. And so stories can be very, very powerful.
Well, that's such an important point, too, because I think when we talk about stories organizationally, we often think of external stories that we would tell about us.
Yes.
But I love – and those have value in a different way, but I love what you're talking about with the role that internal stories play in – I like that you said the tribal knowledge too, because I think in building that community of service internally, you know, you've got your principles, your values, all of these things that you teach from. But I think that those stories are really instructive as well.
What's interesting, I will mention one of the names we did interview for the book I mentioned already, Nordstrom, and you repeated it. And I met with Nordstrom's chief marketing officer at the time. He's since left the company. And I had heard a great story about one of the Nordstrom co-CEOs that I wanted to be able to quote in the book. It fit perfectly one of the different drivers, as we call them, of the Me to Be book, the second book. And I met with him in downtown Seattle, and he said, I'm sorry, but I can't let you use that story from one of our co-CEOs. And I was disappointed, but he told me that they just didn't want the CEOs and the executives didn't want the stories to be about them. They wanted the stories to be about the associates, the individuals that you deal with at a Nordstrom store when you call Nordstrom.com. Yeah. So I said, well, can you give me any of those stories? And they wound up sending me 10 stories that they use in training classes. And we quote one of them in the book. And it was a good exemplar of how Nordstrom wants to do. It's like going over and above, working late at night for a customer who really expressed this need that some companies would say, well, sorry, we're not operating in those hours or we can't help you. But Nordstrom went above and beyond to do that. And that's what they want to reinforce to their company.
Well, I think that's such an important point, too, because I think that's where a lot of organizations get lost on story, too, that they focus on stories where they're the main character or they're the hero. Mm-hmm. You know, the bigger level brand, as opposed to, as they note, the frontline associate or even the customer themselves.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And most companies have stories. Well, every company, I shouldn't even say, but every single company has stories floating around like crazy. What I think distinguishes some of these customer experience leaders and companies that have really great brands is that they collect those stories. They do something with them. And they share them. They don't curate them in the sense of, I mean, they even share bad stories. I mean, it's equally important to talk about things that did not go well so we can learn from them. And these stories, as we've been saying for the last few minutes, come from all sorts of different channels and mechanisms. A salesperson talking to a prospect, here's a story. Is there any way for that salesperson to bring it back? Someone doing field support. Or home install for, let's say, a cable TV system. Here's a story from that consumer at home. Is there any way for that company to capture that story? Usually not. So unfortunately, I don't know the percentage. I'd guess 90-some percent of stories never really get anywhere. But the customer did say something. They did express something. They did offer something. And I think the challenge that we've got is to try to make a much wider net and pull all those experiences or stories in.
Well, and you make such a good point about a story losing its power if it's not told, if it doesn't go anywhere.
Exactly.
Even the bad ones. I think that's the other thing. We're so afraid of, you know, making mistakes, which Everybody does. Everybody does. And I think we are so focused on kind of rewriting the course of events that we've never made a mistake that many probably can't imagine collecting a bad story, much less sharing it.
Well, what you mentioned the Global Operations Council that I chair. A quick story on that one is about 15 years ago, a guy who I didn't know at the time named Alan Winters was working at Sprint PCS, the mobile part. And he called me up and said, gosh, you know, I don't go to too many conferences anymore because conferences are generally all, you know, the sky is blue, everything is rosy, this is a great story. He says, I want to hear about stuff that didn't work so I can learn lessons, and no one's really going to get up there and say, here's something that failed. So he said, can we get together with some other like-minded people and just sit around and talk about stuff that works and doesn't work? And over the 15 years, Alan's been a very active part of that group, and now we've grown it to 41 companies. So the tagline tells everything. It's sharing best practices and worst experiences. And these companies do share those, and they learn from each other. They find out, whoa, wait a minute, I was about ready to go with that vendor, or wait a minute, now you're telling me that particular process or KPI or methodology doesn't work? Well, tell me why. Oh, gee, we were going to do that too. Well, what did work? And so you can learn so much by listening to other companies and other colleagues that where things have not gone that well.
Well, I think that's such a great point, and I love that the charter of that group of getting together mm-hmm. to share those, because I also think it makes it easier to do it when there's strength in numbers. I mean, like you said, stand up and tell a story about a big mistake you made is a scary charge, but if everybody has to do that, then we'll relax a little bit more.
We will, and those stories stay inside the room. I was working with one of my colleagues who lives in London, and Peter talks about something over there called Chatham House Rules, which is a practice in England that says anything you say in this room stays in this room. I guess it ties back to some political or other historical basis in England. But anyway, the idea of those rules is that if someone is willing to share something that didn't go very well, a worst experience, and it's going to stay in the room. It's not going to get out in any sort of form. So everyone feels safe to be able to share those. And I think going back to the company point of view, if companies can make it feel safe for their employees to fess up that things didn't work well, then other employees will learn from that in training, on the floor, wherever it might be, and then they'll say, okay, well, gosh, maybe I better be careful about that particular situation the next time that I face because it looks like it didn't work for George, and I want to make sure it works for me.
In thinking about kind of the online experience and the human service that goes with that, mm-hmm. it seems like the logical progression at least in what you hear about, would be, you know, automation, AI, chatbots. Are tools like that reaching a functional level of service? Most of what I'm hearing seems pretty basic.
Well, there's always a quest for degrees of automation, Nick, because the in-person experience is so expensive and can be so variable. So one of the ways you deal with the expenses, you either work with part-time workers, or maybe you go offshore, or maybe agents can work at, people can work at home and maybe take a small pay cut. So the cost side has, you know, various ways to remediate. The variability is a challenge. So how do you deal with variability of answers? So you come up with scripts or detailed knowledge bases that an employee is supposed to use, and then you have to hold them to that consistent type of response to a question. And there are companies that do a good job in terms of making their answers more consistent. But having said that, a lot of organizations are saying, we've seemed to have exhausted the cost remedies. We don't want to dig any more deeply there. We've done as well as we think we can in terms of the consistency of the responses and the knowledge value and so forth. So let's start exploring degrees of automation or AI or chatbots, the three things you mentioned. So automation has been around for quite a while, with website FAQs, with IVR systems that sometimes will give you your bank balance before you have to talk to a customer service agent. It just recognizes who you are and says, hey, by the way, if you want to know your bank balance, it's, you know, $35.22. And someone goes, oh, that's okay. Or it might say, if you're interested in whether your last check cleared, here's the last check that cleared. So automation has been around for a while to reassure customers or to give them an answer that is anticipated. What's happening is that some of the AI and chatbots are a little bit off-putting to customers. They appear to have the personas of a company or the personas of an individual that company is trying to project, but they may not resonate very well to customers, and the customer might say, well, you know, that chatbot looks kind of nice and the answers seem to be okay, but I want the reassurance of talking to a real person. So I think we're still going through that evolution or that growth path.
Well, and I think back to your examples of some of those statements too, of you make it easy for me. Mm-hmm. And it just seems like there's mm-hmm. such a potential for snags in that, unless, you know, to save on the company side, which of course is usually a goal, but if it comes at the expense of some mm-hmm. of those very, very fragile exchanges that we, you know, that we might not see, so we might not value as much mm-hmm. as we do. I think that's the real kind of hidden piece of those statements that could look just so commonplace, and it would be easy to overwrite them with something that is cheaper.
There's a lot of misspent effort and monies, Nick, on automation. You can see that right now. Forcing automation before you can talk to somebody, filling out a long script online before you're trying to have you self-diagnose, when really what you want to do is you just want to get an email off or a chat session launched, and you don't really want to have to go through this long triage. So I think companies are, if the companies that try something like that realize it's not working and then back off of it, they back down from it. Those are the ones that are learning. They're learning from their customer experience, and the companies that don't learn from it and just push more and more of that out there. And a bad example would be a high-tech firm that might, in response to a search query, give you 100 different responses. You know, there's no way I'm going to look at 100 responses. I want maybe two or three high potential hits to what I'm searching for. If there isn't a high potential hit, I want to just be able to launch an email or a chat session or be routed to a customer service rep. So I think there are some bad examples of automation or delays in live support that unfortunately are out there still.
Yeah, just kind of the probably some of the natural growing pains.
Mm-hmm. All right.
So, Bill, as we wrap up, what is a brand that has made you smile recently?
I like to smile. It doesn't happen enough when I have brand experiences. I tell you, it actually was very recently, Nick. It was yesterday morning, and I took my car into the shop, and there were three people there who could have helped me. Three different service advisors, I guess they call them, and there's a guy who's kind of like he was like the greeter, and the greeter said, "Oh, you know, you're first here today. We just opened, and you can just pick anybody." So I said, "Okay." So I picked I picked the first person, and he started to pull my account. And then there was a woman at the third table who recognized me, remembered me, that first point member from my book, and she popped over and said, "Oh, I'll help Bill." She remembered my name, and so. She brought me over to her desk. Again, I was early customer, so no one was really very busy. And so she pulls my account and she looks, verifies everything. And then she looks over at me and she says, "So Bill, are you going to be running today? Are you going to go for a run today?" And I went like, "No, actually, I ran yesterday." And she says, "I just remember you like to run." So was that on some sort of a information knowledge base? Probably not. I think she just remembered me, but it made me feel recognized. You know, you remember me, as I said, was one of the seven drivers of the book. And I got a loaner car. She arranged for the loaner car, and that was really nice going along the way. It happens to be Tesla, the name of the company. And I've been a Tesla owner for quite a while, and I've always found that type of personalization and appreciation of me as a customer with companies like Tesla. So yeah, that put a smile on my face when she kind of took over getting me set up, got me in the process quickly, made it easy for me, and even asked me a nice little line about my running. So
that's great, and it's. You tell the story, and it sounds like it would be an easy way to get a smile, and yet, it wasn't in a complex database somewhere that was.
I don't think so.
Yeah,
it might have been. There are companies that are trying to do that. You know, they're trying to have all these demographic family type data in a file, but it would have sounded wooden from someone who would say, "Oh, Bill, how are you doing with your running?"
With your running. Well, so, and yeah,
more natural,
and especially too, and how it would get from wherever it is stored in front of the person that then the person could deliver in a seamless human way. So that's got a lot of steps to it. So it was probably the good old fashioned way.
And there's nothing there's something to be said about that too, Nick.
Yeah. So Bill, where can folks go to learn more about who you are and what you do?
I think probably the best way is on my LinkedIn profile. You can search me for under Bill Price for LinkedIn. Bill Price Antuit, Antuit, for LinkedIn. That's probably the best way. I've got some summary of what I do there, a couple of slideshows, and my email address is on there as well. So happy to follow up with anybody.
Awesome. Well, we will link up to all of that in our show notes. Bill, thank you for joining us on Brand.
My pleasure, Nick. Thanks very much.
And before we go, I always like to flip the microphone around to our community. Recently, Darren DeMattis gave us a shout on Twitter for our episode on influencer marketing featuring Lee Oden of Top Rank Marketing. Thank you, Darren, and thank you, Lee, for being on the show. And as noted, you can find links to everything we talked about at branddrivendigital.com. You can subscribe to the show there via iTunes and Stitcher. Speaking of iTunes, if you like what you're hearing, head over there, give us a quick rating and review, help others find the show. And remember, On Brand is brought to you by my book, Get Scrappy, Smarter Digital Marketing for Businesses Big and Small. Order now at Amazon and check out getscrappybook.com for special offers and extras. Until next week, I'm Nick Westergaard, and I'll see you on the internet.
This has been the On Brand Podcast, presented by Brand Driven Digital. For show notes, links, and more, go to onbrandpodcast.com. Remember, you can subscribe to the show and leave a rating and review at iTunes and Stitcher. Thanks for listening.
This podcast is heard along the Marketing Podcast Network. For more great marketing podcasts, visit marketingpodcasts.net.